You read starting verse 28, Philippians 1. In no way alarmed by your opponents, which is a sign of destruction for them, but of salvation for you, and that too from God. For to you it has been granted for Christ's sake, not only to believe in him, but also to suffer for his sake, experiencing the same conflict which you saw in me and now hear to be in me.
Do you ever wish sometimes that you could get a report card again? Do you remember what that was like? Some of us, it's a little bit further back there than others. Some of us are still getting them. But do you remember what it was like when you got those report cards? Do you remember how nervous you used to get when that day came? Like you were counting down the days on the calendar, it seemed like, until, oh man, it's the end of the quarter, it's the end of the semester, it's the end of the year, man, I hope I did okay on all of my assignments. I hope that I can get through this. I hope that I pass and get to go on to the next grade. I know it was always a scary time for me. It seemed like it was that time when your heart, it just felt like it was about to beat out of your chest, especially when you were a kid. What about as a parent? You were a parent, you know, parents know their children better than anyone. When it was time for your child's report card to come out, did you ever get nervous? Did you ever wonder what was going to be on that report card? And pretty sure you knew and pretty sure that your child wasn't going to be happy when they got home from school that day. But wouldn't it be nice sometimes today if we could get a report card? If you could walk into your job sometimes, if your boss would hand you that report card. You know, sometimes, you know, we think we're doing an excellent job. We've got all of our bases covered and we're there. And sometimes we're lacking in so many areas. And the places that we really need to work on are the places that we seem to miss the most sometimes. I think that it would be a little bit scary to get a report card, even as an adult, having a job and all that good stuff. If your boss did hand you that report card, your heart would probably start to beat fast again, I would think. But what would your report card look like? If somebody were to hand you that right now and say, you know, I've been looking at you, I've been watching what you do, and here you go, here's what you need to work on. Would you have all A's? I hope so. I only got that a couple of times in my life. That was a pretty special thing. Most of the time I needed a lot of work. But what would yours look like? What would your spiritual report card look like? If God were to walk in the back doors and on your way out tonight, he handed you each your report card, what do you think it would look like? Would you have a good report? Especially when you get down there to the end and the teacher is allowed to make comments on your performance in class. See, my mind always said that I didn't talk loud enough, or I didn't talk enough, and my sisters, she talked all the time. I could never get her to be quiet. What would your spiritual report card look like? What about the churches? If God were to give the Sunset Church of Christ a report card, what do you think it would look like? Because that's pretty much what we're reading about here in Revelation, is the church's report card. So if this was God, if this was Jesus saying, write a letter to the Sunset Church of Christ, what kind of grades do you think we would be getting? Would we be where we need to be? What does this church look like? Would it look like the report card of the church in Ephesus that we talked about last week? They had left their first love. Would ours look like that? Have we forgotten what it's all about? You know, there we read about the mark of a true and living church, and that is the love of Christ. The love for Christ. The love that Christ has for you and I, the mercy and the grace that we've received from him. The mark of a true and living church is love. The second mark, I believe, is suffering. And I believe that this suffering proves the genuineness of our love. And if our love is where it needs to be, we're probably going to be doing a little bit of suffering for it. Would you look with me at the report card that our second church gets, and that's the church in Smyrna, Revelation chapter 2 and verse 8. Revelation chapter 2 and verse 8. I know sometimes suffering is a negative term, and one that we don't really like to think about, is I don't like to suffer any more than the next person in this room. But I think that maybe that's where we're at, or where we need to be. Verse 8, "And to the angel of the church in Smyrna write the words of the first and the last, who died and came to life. I know your tribulation and your poverty, that you are rich, and the slander of those who say that they are Jews and are not, but are a synagogue of Satan. Do not fear what you are about to suffer. Behold, the devil is about to throw some of you into prison, that you may be tested. And for 10 days you will have tribulation. Be faithful unto death, and I will give you the crown of life. He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. The one who conquers will not be hurt by the second death." Would our report card look a little bit like that? I really hope that it does. I really, really hope that it does, because love is not the problem for the church in Smyrna. Evidently, they have not left their first love. Evidently, they still have it, because they are willing to suffer for Christ. Most of them probably, at this point, are suffering for Christ. You know, I'd like to think that their attitude towards this was something like that of Peter and John in Acts chapter 5, where they were able to rejoice because they were counted worthy to suffer for Christ. Can you imagine what that attitude would be like? You know, most of us, when we're faced with some kind of trial, when we're faced with some kind of problem in our lives, I know I've been guilty of this probably in the last, 30 minutes or so. We don't like that feeling that it brings upon us. How would you feel if you were a Christian in the town of Smyrna there, and you were reading the first part of this letter, you came to verse 9, "I know your tribulation and your poverty, and the slander of those who say that they are Jews"? What kind of feelings would that bring in you if this was Jesus speaking this to you? Would it feel sometimes like those terrible parents' meetings, parent-teacher meetings? Do you guys remember those in school? I know that too, because that was a lot of the times when you got your very first report card of the year. It was when your mom and dad have to go to the school and they have to meet with the teacher. And it was always a scary time, I think, for parents, because this is when you get judged on your biological output, on your children, you know. There's always that one problem kid in class, and you always hope it's not yours. You know, when the teacher walks in and they're like, "Oh, Mr. and Mrs. Kidwell, glad you're here." I think if I was reading this letter or hearing this letter for the first time, I might have the feeling of those parents who sit there going, "Oh no, not my kid. Please, not me. I have a good kid." It was a dangerous thing to be a Christian in the church of Smyrna. It was a dangerous thing because they faced persecution from at least two different sources. One was from a sect of people called the Dia Roma. This was Rome personified as a goddess. You know, they would worship the emperor, basically. They would worship the empire because Rome, at this point, was as good as it got. It was at the height of its empire. In 195 AD, they had built a temple. There had been like a competition throughout the entire empire of Rome to be able to build a temple to the Emperor Tiberius, and Smyrna had won. They won this competition. They were the only city in the entire empire that was privileged enough to be able to erect this huge monument to their god king. The Dia Roma, if you see, was a matter of pride for these people. They took pride in being able to worship their emperor, to be able to call him Lord. And don't you bet that Caesar was eating it up. He loved every second of it. But these people, they refused to call Caesar Lord. They refused, when they walked by this temple, to sprinkle... Oh, goodness, just lost the word. Lost it. Completely lost it. They refused to sprinkle incense at the altar that was before his statue at the opening of this temple when they walked by. And because of that, because they wouldn't call Caesar Lord, they were being persecuted. Because Smyrna was a city of great pride. They took pride in the fact that they were able to build this temple. It's also very likely that they were facing persecution from the Jews. You guys remember them, don't you? It was the Jews who at Jesus' crucifixion cried the loudest to Pilate. It was the Jews who yelled the loudest, "Crucify him!" It was also the Jews who chased Paul all over the world. They chased him through Derbe, they chased him through Lystra. They chased him into Corinth, they chased him into Athens. Persecution is a word that we like to use a lot. We use it a lot, we talk about it a lot, but I don't think that you and I will ever know what it is. At least I pray that we don't know what it is. That we don't know what it's truly like to be persecuted. It's a very difficult thing to wrap our minds around, but I think their suffering, if we look at the text, took at least four forms. If you want to look at them with me. Verse 9, poverty. It's hard to think of, in Smyrna, a very prosperous city, it's hard to think of there being poor people in a prosperous city sometimes. You know, when we think of some of the bigger cities around the world, it's not the poor people that we think of first. We see those huge buildings, the skyscrapers, and we think, man, you know, I can't believe how much it would cost, you know, to have my office in one of those, to be able to live in one of those, to even be able to build one of those. We like to think of all the riches. But I want us to consider 1 Corinthians chapter 1 and verse 26, where Paul reminds them, says, "And now remember what you were, my friends, when God called you. From the human point of view, few of you were wise or powerful or of high social standing." You know, if I were reading that just off the top of my head, I would say that most of those in the first century who were being converted were not rich people. They were not people in high standing. Or maybe it was this, that perhaps the gospel has the same problem that it does today. It doesn't appeal to the rich. It doesn't appeal to those who have all the money that they don't need. You know, they have their money, they're able to please themselves, they don't need God. One author suggested this, that maybe they had heard the gospel, they had been inspired so much that they gave until it absolutely hurt. That they gave away all of their money until they themselves were in poverty. Yet another author suggested that maybe their newfound faith and the morals that were in it led them to better business practices. That they didn't lie, they didn't cheat, they didn't steal. They didn't take the easy buck where maybe the next guy would, and because of that, their businesses were suffering. Whatever it is, I think that it's fair to remember that poverty is often a part of discipleship. And being a disciple of Christ, maybe not so much for you and I, but definitely for some of our brothers and sisters in other countries, poverty is a cost of discipleship. Number two, I think that they were suffering slander. Also in verse 9, the slander of those who were Jews, who say that they were Jews and are not. The Jewish people were spreading rumors. They were poisoning people's minds against Christians. All because they didn't want to accept Jesus as Lord. It says that they belonged to the devil, that they were children of Satan. How scary is that? That the chosen people of God, from the Old Testament at least, that the people who God chose to lead out of Israel and the people that He chose to be their God are now lost, are children of the devil. You know, if it can happen then, it can happen now. They had learned his ways. They were out spreading these rumors, and you know that brings up the idea of gossip, doesn't it? Why is it that gossip fascinates us so much? Sometimes I wonder that. It's so easy for us to talk about other people. That was one of the things they really talked about this weekend, was the gossip that we sometimes get involved in. Proverbs 26 and 22 says that the words of a gossip are like delicious morsels that go down into the innermost parts of our bodies. Those delicious morsels, those juicy tidbits about your neighbor. You know what I'm talking about. That you just can't help but tell. The people at Smyrna were quick to fill themselves with these lies. They were quick to ingest these things just as fast as they could, to fill themselves up on them. They also, verse 10, I believe were suffering in prison. We find Paul here a lot. The cells of Jerusalem, of Caesarea, and Philippi had to be filled with the prayers and praises of Christians. Can you imagine what that must have been like? And no doubt, if the prisons of Smyrna weren't filled with them, they were about to be. And on top of prison, verse 10, they were also suffering from death. Death was a very tangible thought to early Christians. And I think that too, you know, sometimes escapes us. I think that somebody could actually die for being a Christian, could actually die for confessing to be a follower of Christ. That's an absolutely absurd idea to us, but it's real. And then sometimes I think it's followed by this thought, why in the world would you do that? Why? Why would you do that? But they were willing to. They were willing to go to death for their Lord. And apparently it was a real threat. One of the best known martyrs of all times was a Smyrna native. Who goes by the name of Polycarp. I thought that was a very interesting thing, something that I didn't know. But suffering seems to be what this letter is about to me. And suffering is the badge, writes Dietrich Bonhoeffer. I think I've talked about him before. It is the badge of a true Christian. The disciple is not above his master. Luther reckons suffering among the marks of the true church. Discipleship means allegiance to the suffering Christ, and it is therefore not at all surprising that Christians should be called upon to suffer. To suffer. Christians through the ages have been called upon to suffer for the cause of Christ. Think of all the things that Paul went through in 2 Corinthians chapter 11. And so many times when people walk up to us and they say, hey man, you go to that church, don't you? No, I don't. I don't go to church there. So many times I think we find ourselves in the place of Peter when it comes to denying Jesus. They say, hey, you were following him. And Peter says, no, that wasn't me. You didn't see me there. We're afraid of, sometimes I think, of what confessing the name of Jesus might bring to us. But it's absolutely nothing to be ashamed of. In fact, it's a privilege to suffer for Christ. It is absolutely a privilege. We read about that in Philippians. It says, don't be afraid of your enemies. Always be courageous. And this will prove to them that they will lose and that you will win, because it is God who gives you the victory. For you have been given the privilege of serving Christ, not only by believing in him, but also by suffering for him. Now you can take part with me in the battle. It is the same battle you saw me fighting in the past, and as you hear, the one I am fighting still. What a courageous statement that is from Paul. We've been given the privilege of serving Christ. And that privilege goes far beyond believing in him. That privilege goes far beyond being able to sit in this church building every Sunday and Wednesday and every day in between. That privilege also trickles down into sometimes you have to suffer a little bit for it, whether it's poverty, whether it's slander, whether it's prison, whether it's death. Sometimes that's what it takes. We can't compromise anything that we know. We can't back down from anything that we know to be true or honest in anything that we do in our life. Christ has called us to a better life. He was sent to this earth to lift us up, to bring us out of the darkness. Who in the world are we to turn Him down? Tonight, are you in the midst of suffering? Are there things going on in your lives? I don't know exactly what's going on in everybody's life right now. You know, we talk about the economy all the time. I know some of us are hurting from that. Some of us are hurting from relationships, from marriages, from friendships. There's all kinds of stuff. Probably not the prison, probably not the death that we find here in Smyrna. But our trials and the things that we go through now are no less significant. Think of the comforts that they received. If there are problems going on in your life right now, and I imagine that there are, I want you to remember the comforts that these folks received. Number 1, verse 8. The Christ is eternal. The words from the first and the last. The one who was there at the beginning, who said, "Let there be light." The one who will be there at the day of judgment to welcome you home. He is eternal. Even verse 1, or chapter 1 and verse 8. "I am the Alpha, the Omega," says the God, "who is and was and who is to come, the Almighty." Number 2. Not only is He eternal, but He is victorious. If you catch the second phrase there in verse 8. Not only is the words of the first and the last, but also the words of the one who died and came to life. He died and He came back from the dead. He conquered death. He conquered evil just for you and just for me. He's eternal. He's victorious. And verse 9, He is all-knowing. He says, "I know your tribulation and your poverty." Isn't that a comforting thought? God knows without us telling Him about it. God knows without us asking about it. He knows what's going on in your life. He knows. All you have to do is take it to Him. All you have to do is ask Him to help you. Also in verse 9, not only is He eternal, victorious, all-knowing, but He is also balanced. He says, "I know your poverty, but you are rich. I know that you think you're poor, but deep down inside you're rich." I like that thought. No matter what we've got going on in our lives, the things that we're going through, however much money we don't have, we are rich. Or at least we can be. Isn't it good to know that God doesn't judge by what kind of clothes you're wearing? God doesn't judge by what kind of car you drive. It is okay to drive a Chevy, Dwight. God doesn't judge by those things. He's balanced. Not only that, He is also in control. Verse 10 says, "Do not fear about you're about to suffer. Behold, the devil is going to throw some of you in prison that you may be tested. And for 10 days you will have tribulation." For 10 days, that's a pretty precise number, isn't it? God is in control. He is in control. And He's not going to let you and I go through things that we can't handle. He is not going to let you and I go through things that He can't pull us through. That's a comforting thought, that God is in control. Also, He is purposeful. If you catch that phrase in verse 10, "You're put into prison so that you may be tested." There was purpose behind what you were going through. Now, sometimes it's always hard to see when you're dealing with it and when you're having to put up with it. It's always frustrating. But in looking back at most things, you can usually find the purpose for it. You can usually see some of the reasoning behind it. He's purposeful. He's purposeful. Not only that, verse 11, He is generous. He's generous. He has rewarded you and I greatly. He has rewarded the church here in Smyrna greatly. Not only are we able to be believers, not only are we able to call ourselves Christians and share in that suffering, but we also get that crown of life. We're able to have that crown of life as part of our reward. And we won't be hurt by the second death. What awesome comfort is that? That Christ is eternal. He's victorious. He's all-knowing. He's balanced. He's in control. The things that He does, the things that you and I go through are with a purpose. And when it's all said and done, if we can survive, because notice that it's the one who conquers will not be hurt by the second death. The message of this letter, I believe, can clearly be pointed straight at you and I. That if we are true, if we are willing to suffer, we don't have to be afraid. Jesus Christ, who is the first and the last, knows us. He knows you and I personally. He controls our destiny and will richly reward us if we can just hang on. And sometimes, isn't that the hardest part? Isn't that hanging on the hardest part when you're down in the depths, when you've hit rock bottom? The hardest thing to do is to hang on. It's so easy to just let go, to just be done with it, to give up and move on. But luckily, we don't have to do any of this alone. We don't have to get through any of this alone. We have a Savior who cares about us, who's not going to let us be there alone. We have a church family who is not going to let us go through it alone. We're here to pick each other up. If there's anything that we can help you with tonight, those problems that you've got in your life, give them to Him. Give them up to Him. If we can help you, if we can prop you up, if we can support you, if you need to be baptized tonight, don't wait. Don't wait any longer. If there's anything we can do for you tonight, please come as we stand and sing.